Charles Dickens was no stranger to America, was he? In his heyday of readings.
Right. He came up a couple of times.
Yes. I remember I was reading a biography of Mark Twain not so long ago. He went to see Dickens read here in New York, and that's where he met the woman who later became his wife.
Ah.
And Twain, too, was a great orator and reader and went on the lecture tour. And to a degree, he was influenced by Dickens' own performance as a reader. Tell me a little bit about that.
As Dickens as a public reader, it was an extraordinary phenomenon. He was almost the great pop star of his day, for want of a better analogy. He began it in middle life. He started reading A Christmas Carol, first of all. His Christmas books were his most popular books. And he discovered that audiences really enjoyed his reading them in public. Then he decided to do it for money. And then he decided to tour this country, America, as well as England. And it was a sort of royal progress. Wherever he went, crowds gathered outside the theaters. The police had to be called to control the crowds. When he went on stage, people rose to their feet and applauded. When he read, some people wept at the sad parts, some people laughed at the happy parts. It was the most extraordinary event. It began, for him at least, as a way of sort of creating a kind of national family, in England at least. But then something took over from him. He started getting more manic. As he got older, he got more obsessed with the readings, and he started doing The Death of Nancy by Sykes in the end of Oliver Twist. And he didn't just play Bill Sykes, he also played Nancy. And he killed himself, as it were, on the stage. And it was apparently one of the most frightening things in the English theatre at the time. People fainted when he did it, but he carried on doing it. His doctors told him, stop now, because your health is getting worse. You can't keep on getting to this peak of excitement. But he kept on doing it. And in the end, it killed him, in a sense. Some people say his characters killed him. By impersonating them so vividly, so dramatically. He exhausted his own strength, and he died a few months after his final reading. So, in a sense, in more than one sense, it was the culmination of his career.
Dickens was always very theatrical, even as a youth, but you write in this beautiful biography that he was always posturing, speaking out loud, grimacing, and making faces and this sort of thing, apparently taking the roles of the characters he was writing from.
Yes, he was very theatrical in every sense. As you say, when he was actually writing, he would get up to the mirror and start making faces and start muttering under his breath. We know that happened because his daughter, who was once recovering from illness, was actually lying in his study, and he forgot all about her and started doing what he normally did. So in a sense, he was enacting each role as it went along. Of course, he didn't only enact the roles. He actually used to say that he could see the characters when he started writing about them. That when he was sitting at his desk, the shapes of Little Nell or Ebenezer Scrooge would come up to him and start tugging at his frock coat so that in order that he'd get on with their destinies. And I believe that, because when he was a boy, he used to say he could see the characters he read about, too. It's a strange gift, a sort of phantasmagoric vision, hallucinatory vision, but he did see these things. But his theatricality went even further than that. He was an intensely theatrical man in every respect. He dressed very colourfully. We always think of the Victorian period as a time when everyone wore black frock coats and black stovepipe hats and generally looked very dour. But he used to go around in bright vermilion waistcoats, in tartan trousers, in blue sky blue overcoats. He looked like an actor, an elderly actor, in the fact. And his manner was that of an actor. Someone once said of him that he always behaved as if he were on an imaginary stage. It was as if he always had sensed an audience around him. And there's certainly a truth to that. And theatricality, as a result, animates both the man and pervades his fiction. There's not one novel of his which doesn't have a sort of theatrical imperative behind it. You can tell that when you look at the ends of the books, because everyone sort of returns at the end. All the characters come back on stage, as it were, make their bow, and then the curtain falls. There's a sort of theatrical life in all of his books.
One of the interesting things about your novel, your biography, is the way you trace Dickens' childhood and how his childhood seems to reappear in the novels that he wrote. So let's look a little bit at Dickens' childhood. He was born in 1812 to relatively genteel, but for the most of the time, impoverished parents. Tell me about his childhood and how this childhood reappeared in his books.
Well, it was one of the strangest childhoods on record. As you say, he was born into a genteel family in 1812. His father was a clerk in the a Navy pay office, a sort of civil servant, I suppose. And he looked set for what you might call a middle-class upbringing. He was a very ambitious, intelligent boy, by all accounts, and wanted to go to school and wanted to become what he called a rich and learned man. But then something happened, something went wrong. The family moved to London. The father got into debt. As a result, the young Dickens, at the age of 12, was put to work in a blacking factory. That's where they put the boot polish into bottles and tied it up with string and got it ready for sale. He was put to work in a blacking factory amongst what he called common men and boys, because you have to remember that people think of Dickens as a great democrat, but he was nothing of the kind. The thing he hated most about going to work was that he was with working class people and having to mix with them.
You should mention at this point that one of his colleagues at the Blacking family was a youth named Fagin.
That's right. He never forgave Fagin's kindness. The Bob Fagin, the boy, was very kind to him. But of course he repaid his kindness by turning him into one of the great monsters of English fiction. The reason he did that was because he hated the thought of, as it were, being brought down to Bob Fagin's level. Even the boy's kindness to him was a sort of stain upon him. And so he, as it were, repaid that act of charity by turning him into the figure we all know about. But not only was Dickens put to work in the blacking factory, his father was incarcerated in the Marshalsea prison for debt. All the family went into the prison with the father. So we have the spectacle of this boy who wanted to be a rich and famous learned man, trudging to work to the blacking factory, then trudging back to the prison to have dinner with his family. His whole life was torn in half as a result. All hopes for his future went. Now, people talk about Dickens being a melodramatic writer, a writer who deals in sensationalism and in a sense romanticism, but you can see how even in the bare facts of that childhood, it didn't seem to be melodrama at all. The things that happened to him were as melodramatic as anything you could find. For him, it was all real. When he wrote about starving children, when he wrote about poor children, when he wrote about feckless families, it was all real for him. That's what happened. And the shape of that childhood animates all of his fiction. Take the Marshalsea prison, for example, where his family were incarcerated. There's not a novel of Dickens in which prisons don't reoccur. In fact, in a novel like Little Dorrit, the whole world becomes a kind of prison. And you find that's just one example of a pervasive thing in his fiction. His childhood experience, his childhood needs, his childhood sufferings are directly responsible for most of the great ideas, most of the great symbols and themes in his great fiction.
Well, there was something else, too, that I would assume helped him to direct his writing in a very forceful way. He became a shorthand reporter in the courts.
That's right. And the one thing about Dickens' novels is his great gift for capturing people's speech, like Cockney speech, when people said V for W or W for V. So Sam Weller doesn't say very, he says wery. And Dickens got that sort of thing absolutely right. And his training for that came from, his being a shorthand reporter, because he learnt how to listen to people and then reproduce what they said very quickly and very exactly in his notebooks. And that's a gift which never deserted him. Of course, he worked also in the House of Commons, which is the English Houses of Parliament, and came to detest politicians as a result, which is why you never find a good politician in any of his books.
Well, his first book was The Pickwick Papers. How did that come about?
That came about by accident. Like most of the salient events of Dickens's life, it happened quite by chance. He was working as a journalist for a paper called The Morning Chronicle. He'd written some sketches of London life, which had been published and were called Sketches by Boz. And then a publisher came to him and said, "We have this idea. We've got a cartoonist, an illustrator working for us, who's doing some plates of Cockney sportsmen. We want someone to write what they called the letterpress for it. In other words, words to complement the pictures. Could you do it?" He said yes, and then discovered that he had a talent for it. It was going to be a monthly serial for, I think, a penny or tuppence. And once he got into the swing of it, he realized that he had a greater gift than even he imagined. And what started out as a simple journalistic venture, his being the sort of second string to a cartoonist, turned out to become one of the greatest novels in the English language. And he learned as he went along. He became a novelist as he went along. In fact, he didn't really think of it as a novel at all until the very end. For him, it was just a monthly serial, like you'd write a monthly serial in a newspaper or a magazine. But out of that experience came The Pickwick Papers. And funnily enough, even before he finished The Pickwick Papers, he started writing Oliver Twist. So you have this extraordinary spectacle of a young man at 24 writing The Pickwick Papers and Oliver Twist simultaneously, both novels of which will last as long as the English language itself survives.
Well, that must be hard to do, to write novels that hold up as well as they do and write them in the form of a serial.
Yeah, well, and also to write them both at the same time. So he'd write Pickwick Papers in the morning and Oliver Twist in the afternoon. And he would have to arrange it so that he knew what was going to happen, where the novel would end each month with the Pickwick Papers, and Oliver Twist was weekly, in fact, and where Oliver Twist would end each week. There was time in later life when he started to get a little bit confused about that. In fact, he got confused with Oliver Twist. If you read that novel, you often find it very difficult to understand exactly what's going on in terms of plot. But Dickens had exactly the same problem. When he started getting towards the end of the book, he had to reread everything he'd written before in order to figure out how to finish it. He couldn't remember the relationship of Oliver Twist to people and so forth. So he himself got confused about what had gone on and had to sort of refresh his memory before he concluded the book.
Dickens probably is the best, I don't know if I should use the word advocate, explainer, describer, I'm groping for the right word, of the Victorian period. He captures it so vividly. Of course, he was there, but then a lot of people were there, and they didn't capture it the way Dickens did.
No, the nearest, I suppose not rival, but the nearest person who gets it is Henry Mayhew, who in his volumes, London Labour and London Poor, describes in a reportorial way the lives of the poor and the indigent and the vagabonds. But Dickens does it on a much grander scale and a much greater scale. What he does is not only reproduce the Victorian age, but embody the Victorian age. Now, we often think of it as a time of repression, sexual hysteria, hypocrisy. Well, those are the concepts we apply to the Victorians. In fact, when we read Dickens's books and when we examine his life, we discover it wasn't like that at all. It was a very very sentimental period in some ways. It was a very emotional period. People weren't afraid to show their feelings at all. Contrary to popular belief about the period, men used to weep in public. They'd go arm in arm down the street, thing impossible to think of today in London. People were very open about themselves. And if there was one great distinction between our period and that and the Victorians, it's the Victorians were much more ready to laugh at themselves than we are. It was a much more exuberant, animated, inventive, theatrical period than most people can have any conception of.
It's interesting to note that Dickens was famous. As you pointed out at the beginning of our chat, he was famous in his own time. There was no real rediscovery of Dickens, was it?
No, not necessarily, but like all writers, he suffered a great deal from critical vituperation. I mean, he always had his public. From the very first book, The Pickwick Papers, he was the most popular novelist in England, in fact, the most popular novelist in the world pretty soon after that. So he always maintained his public with one or two ups and downs. I mean, some novels were more popular than others, but they were always huge readership for them. But what did happen, and is often forgotten, is that by the middle of his life, he was written off by the serious critics as a man whose genius had expired. His later novels, Bleak House, Little Dorrit, Our Mutual Friend, were dismissed. Bleak House was called Sentimental Twaddle.
I believe you mention in the biography that Bleak House is considered his best novel.
Sure. I mean, well, the critics dismissed him, dismissed the novels which we now consider to be his greatest novels. A Mutual Friend's another case in point. Henry James himself, who was, you'd think, of no mean judge of other people's fiction, said it was, of all Dickens' novels, the worst. In fact, by most accounts, it's the best. So Dickens had to face the fact that by the time he was, 35, 40, he was being dismissed as someone whose time had come and gone, whose genius had died down, who I think one paper said he was living on the dying embers of his old genius. And these are the years, in fact, when he was writing his greatest work. So what you might call his critical reception was actually very varied indeed. He only was really rediscovered, you know, in the 60s and 70s of this century. In the 20s, he was considered to be the novelist of the Pickwick Papers, a sort of ebullient, jovial English writer. And it wasn't until relatively recently that he began to be taken very seriously again.
And yet, most of his better-known novels were filmed in the 20s and 30s. We still see them.
That's right, but you'll find what they filmed was the Christmas Carol, Pickwick Papers, the
Great Expectations.
Oh, that's true, Great Expectations.
David Copperfield.
But on the whole, what you have is this image of him as a sort of cross between Mr. Pickwick and Father Christmas, as sort of the novelist of the roaring fire, the turkey, the novelist who spreads benevolence and goodwill. And that's the image of him which carried on until relatively recently. Then they discovered the dark side of Dickens, that there was a fashion for talking about the dark Dickens, the melancholy Dickens. This went on for 10, 15 years. And I think it's only in the last decade that people have begun to see him as an all-round writer, as someone who is possibly the greatest writer of English prose ever, and certainly the greatest novelist in the English language, in the English tradition. People talk about magic realism as though it's something invented by the South Americans, but of all writers, I think Dickens was the great magic realist. And that's an aspect of his genius which has been rediscovered in recent years.
Now, his personal life, there was some controversy regarding that, particularly with regard to his marriage to his wife, Catherine. They had 10 children, and yet their relationship ended abruptly. What happened there?
He got rid of her, as simple as that. He became infatuated with a young actress whose name was Ellen Ternan, and became unhappy with the claims or demands of his wife, who had, as you say, raised his children and looked after him, and he simply wrote her out of his life, in an almost literal sense, wrote her out. The peculiar thing about Dickens is that at times of crisis or stress or drama, he would reach for images from his fiction in order to control other people, in order to identify other people. For example, at the time of crisis with his wife, he actually put in the public newspapers an account of his own wife, saying that she was an unfit mother, that the children turned to stone when they were in her presence. Now, none of this was true. But what he was doing was taking one of the enduring images of his fiction, which is the cold mother, the unfeeling mother, and applying it to his own wife against all the evidence. It seems that he was a man who could not deal with the world unless it was on his own imaginative terms. He had to control the world, just as he controlled the world in his fiction. He had to control the world in reality by transposing the fictional context and making sense of them in his own life. That's, for example, why I don't think he had a sexual affair with the actress Ellen Ternan. I think it was a sexless relationship with someone he idealized as a young virgin, because Ellen Ternan has all the characteristics of one of the creatures of his own fiction, the sexless young ladies who pop up time and time again in his fiction. And it seems that he recreated in his life exactly what he created in his own fiction. In that sense, he was a writer who held on to his imagination against all the odds.
Let me ask you a few questions about how you came to write Dickens's biography. It's certainly a scholarly book, and yet it's not laid out in a scholarly way. There are no footnotes, for example. I believe in some of the biographical data that HarperCollins sent over, said that you began the book in 1988. That's not very long ago, and this book is almost 1,200 pages.
I began, yes. I don't know exactly how I managed to do it now when I look at it. As you say, it looks so big, looks so long. I began the research in 85, and I think I researched as much and as lengthily as I could possibly do under the circumstances, and I did begin writing in 88. I think, how can I put it? When you live with someone like Dickens long enough, you begin to understand something about the way he worked, the way he operated, if you like. And his catchwords were determination, energy, keep on going, write every day, stay at your desk for a certain amount of time, get through the work that way. And I did exactly the same thing. It sounds like a lot of words, but in fact, if you work methodically and if you work on a daily basis, you'll find that it happens almost without your knowing it.
The pages pile up is what you're saying.
The pages pile up, yeah.
But it's more than pages, too. I mean, there is obviously an enormous amount of research that went into this book, and I was reading your notes in the back. There were, I think, something like 66 pages of notes alone, just to show your sources for each individual chapter. I had no idea there was so much source material for Dickens.
I didn't know how much material there was when I began. That's one of the things that surprised me about the whole enterprise, because I made a rule to myself, a promise to myself, that I would read everything Dickens wrote at least three times. You can't just read it once, because then you forget it. Twice is not enough, so I'd read everything three times. But not only did Dickens write 15 rather long novels, he was a journalist. He edited a weekly newspaper for the last 20 years of his life. He wrote endless letters. He wrote plays. And that became itself an enormous undertaking. And then I thought, well, I must read everything which has been written about Dickens. So I had to go to the British Library, which is part of the British Museum, and go through the catalogue of Dickens' criticism and just read everything from A to Z. That was the only way I thought I could master the material, because there's no point in writing the life of a man like Dickens unless you knew absolutely all there was possible to know. I mean, there have been many other lives of Dickens for a start.
Were you able to retain all of this mentally?
Either mentally or on paper, yeah. I mean, I took
notes.
Sure, yes, otherwise it would have gone in one ear and out the other, so I had to keep notes all the way through. With a life of that kind, which was so various and so diverse and so complicated, it wasn't just a question of taking notes, it was a question of interpreting material almost on a daily basis. Part of the reason I wrote that book was to make sense of Dickens in a new way, in order to relate the life and the work in a fresh way, which meant almost working on his life day to day. So I'd know what he did on a certain time and a certain day and carry on through that, not just for the sake of scholarly accuracy, but it was only by getting as close as I could to his actual existence that I thought I might be able to get close to the sources of his artistic inspiration. It comes out in small matters, like, for example, about 5 weeks before he started writing Dombey and Son, he ran over the dog of a little girl in the park, and the girl was very upset, and he writes about it in one of his letters. A few weeks later, in Dombey and Son, he gives Florence Dombey a little dog called Diogenes, who appears in the book. It's in little moments like that where you see, by some act of imaginative restitution, he put a dog in his fiction and he killed the dog in life. It's the tiny little things like that which gets you closer to Dickens than you otherwise might. But to get that close, you really do need to work hard at the source material, and you have to work hard at collating the material. You have to make sure that everything is in the right order and everything starts to work together.
Yeah, I hope you used a computer.
Not for that, no. That was all done on paper, I'm afraid.
There are a couple of elements in the book that might have some of the academics scratching their heads. I noticed that there is an interview with yourself in the book, and also an interview, I guess, Dickens and yourself are talking. You can tell it's different because there's a change in the typeface.
Sure. I'd written the book, as it were, straight. The biography straight, and I knew there was something missing. There was something nagging at me. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't put my finger on what was missing. I did all the notes, and, you know, to all intents and purposes, the book was finished, but it just wasn't right. And I went on holiday, and it was while I was on holiday that those seven fictional episodes occurred to me. I mean, I actually just wrote them straight out, and I knew where they would go in the book, and I knew what they did for the book. And then once I'd done them, once I put them in the book seemed to me to be complete. I knew that it was finished. It's very hard now to explain why I put them in.
Well, I think I know why you put them in.
Why was that? Tell me.
I think it springs from your own novelistic impulses.
Yes, that's true. What I didn't want to do, I wanted to, as it were, push the boundaries of biography back a bit, because I've never thought of biography as being a separate discipline. I've always thought of it as being very closely related to fiction. In fact, and certainly in my own case, I do write fiction as well as biography. It's part of the same activity as far as I'm concerned. The best analogy I can give you is it's like going from a novel to a biography is like, for me, going from a symphony to an opera. It's a different form, but it's the same music. And in a sense, I wanted to write a biography which would be as interesting as a novel, and in fact, to a certain extent, use novelistic techniques. Because there's no doubt that biographies are essentially fictional forms, however you like to dress it up. You know, they have a beginning, a middle, and end. They have a character, they have a plot, they have a motive, they have other subsidiary characters. To all intents and purposes, a biographer, when he starts his work, when he gets on with his work, is behaving more or less like a novelist. You can't escape the need to make it novelistically interesting and intriguing in the same way as you would a regular novel, as far as I'm concerned.
Dickens is not your first biography, is it?
No, I wrote A Life of T.S. Eliot, which came out about 4 years ago. Then before that, I wrote A Shorter Life of Ezra Pound. But Dickens is my first attempt to get close to an English writer. I wanted to do that very deliberately, because people talk about Dostoevsky as representing the soul of the Russian people, for example. But I've always thought that Dickens represents the soul of the English people in his very paradoxes, in his inability to be serious for very long, in his theatricality, in his sentimentality, in his pathos, in his sense of the ridiculous. All these characteristics strike me as being particularly English, and I wanted to get to the heart of the phenomenon. I wanted to understand what it was to be the nature of his precise Englishness, his sense of life, his sense of the theatre, his sense of fiction, his sense of literature. And I almost used Dickens, in a sense, in order to get across to myself as much as anything else that sense of English life. I also used him in a way in order to explore the 19th century, because in my previous novels, And I wrote a novel called Hawksmoor, which was roughly set in the early 18th century. I wrote a novel called Chatterton, which was set in the mid-18th century. I wrote a novel about Oscar Wilde, which was set in the late 19th. I wanted to get to grips with the main burden of the 19th century. And in a way, I used Dickens in order to recreate that period, in a sense. That was part of my design. I wanted to recreate the whole of the mid-19th century, the early 19th century. I wanted to make sense of it for myself as much as for anybody else.
Well, to wrap up our discussion, there's one other thing we should probably talk about for a moment about Dickens. He was a great social reformer as well, wasn't he?
He was. But people always assume for that reason that he was a sort of liberal, a liberal and a Democrat. In fact, he was nothing of the kind. When it came to his ordinary life, he was a very strict man, a very conservative man, a disciplinarian. There's a story of, for example, when he heard a woman swearing in the street of London. He took the woman and marched her into the local police station and had her arrested. Not even the police knew it, but there was, in fact, a little-known law against swearing in public, and he knew about it, and he made sure the woman was put on trial for it. So you see, in his ordinary instinctive behavior, he was a very strict man. But we were talking about his childhood. We were talking about the family's incarceration for debt. We were talking about his life as a manual laborer. Whenever a social issue touched upon his memory of these events, whenever it was a case of children or a case of prisons, all the alarm bells of his nature, as it were, rang out, and he changed. Then he became the effusive man, the sentimental man, the man of great pity and sorrow. It's almost as if he was identifying himself once more with the people who had suffered. And then he became the humanitarian, then he became the social reformer. But in ordinary life, he was nothing of the kind. His conservative instincts are exemplified in many respects. For example, he supported the South in the American Civil War, which, on the face of it, was an extraordinary thing for an English social reformer to do, but he did. He believed that prisons, when he came to America, he believed the prisons were too lenient. He said the only purpose of prison is for strict punishment, and the Americans were treating their inmates too kindly. So you see, there's a strange paradox in his social pronouncements. On the one hand, this great reformer, on the other hand, this very strict conservative.
Peter Aykroyd, wrap things up with you touched upon this a little earlier, but I'd like for you to give me an assessment of Dickens as a literary figure and what the future might hold. Oddly enough, that's an odd question, but what the future might hold for Dickens? Will he continue to be read far into the centuries?
There's no doubt that he will be. As I said, for me, he represents the greatest achievement in English literature, maybe in English language. I could put it differently, I suppose, by saying he was the last of the great... I could put it differently by saying he was the last of the great 18th century novelists. He's in the tradition of Smollett and of Fielding, but he's also the first of the great symbolic novelists. He's the first writer in English who brought poetry into the novel, in a sense, who understood the workings of the individual consciousness, who was a romantic, as it were, in prose. People talk about him as being as English as Smollett and as Fielding, but he's also as English as William Blake and as English as Turner. In other words, he's something of a visionary. So for those reasons, he'll survive. Also, and I suppose preeminently, he will survive because of his humor. He's the greatest comic novelist England's ever produced. And when you think of the characters who he created, whether it's Mrs. Gamp, or whether it's the Pecksniffs, or whether it's the Micawbers, whether it's David Copperfield's mother, or
I always like Uriah Heep myself.
Or Uriah Heep. Those characters will live forever. I mean, there's something about them which they have a sort of undying quality. And as long as people are interested in Scrooge, and as long as people are interested in Oliver Twist, and as long as people are interested in Tiny Tim, then Dickens will be read and remembered. But he should not be remembered just as a comic novelist. He should be remembered as the greatest all-round novelist I think England's ever produced.
Dickens by Peter Aykroyd. It's quite an achievement. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.